Thank you for the talk on generosity, because that's a perfect segue into loving kindness. As I said last night, practices like loving kindness are often considered practices of generosity. It's like generosity of the spirit. It may or may not manifest as material generosity, but it's this sense of offering our presence, thanking somebody, listening to them when we're not sort of obliged to, but actually gathering our attention and being there with somebody, wishing them well, noticing people, looking at them rather than through them. All kinds of aspects of loving kindness are really aspects of generosity, and so it is considered a practice of generosity, as is compassion, as an example. And so with material generosity, which we often look back at because it's so much more concrete, it's a great way of understanding different elements of generosity of the spirit. With material generosity, the teaching is that the best kind of generosity comes from some sense of inner abundance. We could give for all kinds of different reasons and in all kinds of different ways. We could give because we feel obliged, or as an exchange, or it can be an activity that is coming from some sense of inner abundance, because we know, again, in the realm of material generosity, that the amount one has externally is actually not the biggest determinant of how generous one is. There's something happening inside, because we probably all know people who don't have all that much in a material sense, but they're incredibly generous. And we may also know people who have a whole lot more by any external measure, but they never have an internal feeling, it seems, of even having enough. And so out of that place of deprivation inside, it's quite difficult to give, right? It's a little bit analogous to craving, as is talked about in the Buddhist psychology. When we fixate on what we don't have rather than on what we do have, then there's a sense of depletion inside. It's very hard in that state to give, to offer. And this comes up again as we examine this state known as sympathetic joy, which is another ally of loving kindness. Being happy for someone else's happiness, someone else's success. That's awfully hard anyway. And it's harder when you feel like you've got nothing going, right? So the same holds true with loving kindness. There's some sense of, if not inner abundance, inner sufficiency that we actually cultivate, and that is our own happiness. It's been very ironic for me I have two books now with the word happiness prominently in the title, and my first book, Loving Kindness, had happiness in the subtitle, but that wasn't so bad. These two have been worse in that there's been a fair amount of pushback, you know, like as though happiness meant just being selfish and wanting to have a good time all for yourself, or the kind of superficiality we might associate with being happy-go-lucky, or the kind of endless seeking of pleasure, which we do anyway. You don't have to buy another book for that. You know, but when I'm talking about happiness, it's much more in that sense of that inner resource. We feel we have something to give. Even if it's just our presence, even if it's just a care, like a silent wish, may you be happy. So there's some sense of inner confidence or abundance or sufficiency that is our own happiness. And that is not a selfish thing, because when we don't have it, we burn out. Or our giving becomes like awfully strange, right? We're exhausted. We're depleted. We're fatigued. We're overcome. That's not a great state in which to try to take care of someone else or help someone else or even pay attention to someone else. Isn't that what happens, you know, when we're in one of those states? It's like our energy just implodes. So that's not a very useful, skillful state. Our unhappiness is not selfish. It's really the resource of what allows us to keep caring and connecting and giving. You know, this is what I think every one of my colleagues has both written about and spoken about, that very common image, which for a long time I refused to use. I said, it's such a cliche, I can't even use it. And that is when you're sitting on an airplane and the safety announcements are being made and the flight attendant says, if the cabin pressure drops and the oxygen mask should come down, put your own on first before you try to take care of anybody else. And I was saying to a writer friend of mine once, I said, I can't even bear to use it. You know, like, you hear it everywhere now and everybody uses it and it's such a cliche. And she said, oh, that's interesting. She said, I was sitting on an airplane the other day and they made that announcement and the person in the seat next to me said, I could never do that. I could never put my own oxygen mask on first. And I said, oh, maybe I can use it. Like, still like a really relevant thing. So that's what we talk about in terms of happiness. It's that resourcefulness. It's knowing. Maybe I can't fix the situation, but I can be here. We have some juice. We have some energy, in contrast to feeling so overcome or shattered or broken or exhausted. All those states that can so easily happen. So loving kindness is like generosity of the spirit. And it begins classically with the offering of loving kindness to ourselves as this kind of resource building within. It's not like we do it as a project, like I will do loving kindness for myself until the happy moment when I love myself totally. You know, we also include others, but it's never wrong to go back to yourself and to keep cultivating, keep generating, keep building that sense of inner resource. Loving kindness is, as you know, many of you, the common translation of the word in the Pali language of the original Buddhist texts. The word is metta, M-E-T-T-A, and I haven't looked at the Insight Meditation Society brochures that got here, but IMS is a large building, large brick building with white pillars, and it has that word up above, metta. So often that's in our graphics, metta. As I've said, you know, when we bought the building, we moved in February 1976. It was a Catholic novitiate. It was operated by the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, and that's what it said up above the doorway. And we got somebody to get up on a very tall ladder one day, a very cold day, and said, can you please rearrange those letters, Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, so it says something about us. And they got up there and they came up with metta. And what then ensued was a tremendous debate. And I will say, you know, we debated everything because we had no models for what we were trying to do. This is the first center that had roots in the Buddhist tradition, but as I said, it was totally non-sectarian. which was begun and run by Westerners, not referring back to a particular teacher, not even a particular lineage, because there were different styles of mindfulness meditation that were taught there. So we didn't know anything. And, you know, as I often say, actually, we had a big debate about whether to have Buddha statues, which feels very funny saying here on this stage. On the one hand, we said, well, you know, that is true. I mean, for us, that particular group of people, that was the context in which we'd learned all of these things. So it was, as I said, it was the languaging, it was the representation that came most naturally. And it was a mark of gratitude and respect to have a Buddha statue. The idea is that when you look at a Buddha statue, you're not seeing like a legendary figure or a hero, you're seeing something about the capacity of a human being. Because a Buddha is said to have been a human being who had some very deep questions about life, the nature of happiness, the nature of suffering, and was able to come to an answer to those questions through the power of his own awareness, and so can we. So just as he, as a human being, had a capacity for love, compassion, wisdom, connection, so do we. So when you look at a Buddha statue, the idea is that you're really looking at yourself. You're looking at your own true potential as a human being. And it's not just like, oh, the Buddha and I were really together, forget everyone else. It's like on that level, looking at ourselves, of that capacity for wisdom, for love, we see everybody has that same potential. So we look at a Buddha to see ourselves. We look at ourselves to see all beings. That's why one has Buddha statues around. So that was that side. The other side of the debate was Buddha did not teach Buddhism. The Buddha taught a way of life. We're in Barre, Massachusetts. You know, this is not relevant. People are going to be offended. They're going to think this is about becoming a Buddhist. That's beside the point, you know. And then we went back and forth and back and forth. And one day, this U-Haul arrived. And it turned out that Jack Kornfield, when he'd been living in Thailand, not as a monk, but other times, had been like this mad shopper. And he'd bought all these Buddha statues that were sitting in his mother's attic, I think. And he had them shipped up there. So then all of a sudden we had all these Buddhas. We said, okay, we're putting Buddhas around. So we have them still. And it was the same thing with the word metta up above the doorway. Like, we're in America. Nobody knows what that word means. Why do we have a word up there no one understands? It's ridiculous, but it means something to us. And so, and the point of view that felt the word should stay up there prevailed, which I was always very happy about because it was my point of view. I like that. So, metta. I like it because I like when somebody calls for directions and someone answers the phone. They say it's a large brick building with white pillars and it's got this word up above, and then usually the delivery person or whomever says, what does that mean? And we say that means love, or that means loving kindness. Loving kindness is the common translation. I've actually had scholar friends who've said to me, why not just call it love? Why be timid about it? You mean love. It means love. But love, I find, is such a complicated notion for us. It can mean so many different things to any one of us at different times. It might really, frankly, mean a medium of exchange, like I will love you as long as, or I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. And we know that those kinds of states are very conditional and therefore very breakable. Like, really, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. It's not going to last long. I will love you as long as you do exactly what I want in the timetable I have decreed. Right? So metta means something other than that. The literal meaning of the word is friendship. Another way of translating it is gentle. And it's likened to a gentle rain that falls upon the earth. I usually use the idea of connection. It's a powerful sense, a powerful recognition or realization of the fact that our lives are all connected. It doesn't mean that you like somebody. It doesn't mean you're going to give them all your money. It doesn't mean you approve of their actions. It doesn't mean you're going to take them home with you. It's some sense of acknowledgement that our lives have something to do with one another, that we live in an interdependent universe. And as I said last night, the corollary of that is that everybody counts. Everybody matters. Not everyone's going to be your best friend, but everybody counts. Sometimes I use the example of when I was, at one point when I was going to Washington, D.C. to teach, the facility that was being rented was this elementary school. It's since been torn down, but since it was the weekend, that organization used to rent it. So that particular elementary school had its own rules of kindness. And whenever it was, and those rules were like all over the walls, these big pieces of paper in the corridors. So whenever it was time to do walking meditation, we'd actually all stand there and read them because they were so great. And the rules of kindness included things like, don't hurt anyone on the inside or on the outside. And my very favorite rule of kindness was, everybody gets to play. Everybody gets to play. That's the sensibility of metta, of loving kindness. And loving kindness is a fine translation for it. And it's the one I use, but I think it also can be slightly misleading because the word itself or the phrase itself is not so commonly used, like in casual conversation. And so my concern is that it's then going to make the qualities seem somewhat removed from day-to-day life, or kind of arcane or precious in the negative sense. The other great mistake we tend to make is that it's a state of weakness, that it means giving in. To have loving kindness for someone means saying yes, or saying we approve of their behavior, or not protesting, not taking a stand, not insisting on caring for ourselves at the same time. There's all kinds of elements to it, and it's not easy. It's one of the reasons why I like teaching loving kindness so much, because I think it's best done as a kind of experiential exploration. It can be very difficult just in the realm of words to try to feel one's way to what in the world could it mean to have loving kindness for ourselves and for someone else? What could it mean to have compassion for someone and know it is wrong to give in? What could it mean to have compassion for someone and realize I can't fix it? I can't make it all better. It's not in my hands. You know, and so those are things we don't necessarily probe cognitively in the meditation, but we go through a lot experientially till we come to some place. Even if you can't describe it in words, you have a feeling about just what it means to have loving kindness for yourself and for someone else, to have compassion for someone and know it is wrong to give in, to have compassion for someone and realize I can't fix it. You know, so these are very real problems, and they're very real experiences that we kind of deepen an understanding of as we do this practice. So And certainly we're going to talk much more about that and loving kindness in the face of adversity later today and through tomorrow. So there are different ways of categorizing different kinds of meditation practice. We talked a little bit about that this morning. One way, you know, that which emphasizes concentration, that which emphasizes mindfulness. There's another way that meditation practices are sometimes categorized, and that is those practices which are mainly designed to help us be with things as they are, to loosen the grip of those filters and ways we have bias or prejudice or preconception, to loosen the grip of assumption or prior judgment, to help us be with things as they are. And that's any kind of mindfulness that is, any kind of meditation that is using mindfulness as the kind of engine. That's what it's for. To see things in a different level. So many times in questions, as people have come up, they've brought up something like anger, and I've said, you know, well, here's an example. I was practicing once at the Insight Meditation Society, and one of my teachers from India was visiting, this man named Manindra. And, you know, so if he was there, and IMS was already there, so maybe I'd been practicing for 6 or 7 years at that point. And I was feeling some anger in my sitting, and I didn't like it. I kind of thought, all right, 6 years in, certainly should be gone by now. And I said something, I mean, it was probably just even the tone of my voice. Because in describing my experience to Manindra, he got very clearly my disgruntlement at what I was experiencing. And he said, this is how you should be with your anger. He said, imagine a spaceship has landed on the front lawn and these Martians come out and they come up to you and they say, what is anger? What is anger? That's how you should be with your anger. Not, it's right, it's wrong, I need a new therapist, or, you know, I'm going to write that vengeful letter. But what is anger? What do I feel in my body? What are the, what's like the emotional landscape? What's the anger movie? If you take a look at anger and you're not trying to defend it or hate it, and you're just with it, what do you see? See moments of sadness, moments of fear, very, very likely moments of helplessness or powerlessness. In Tibetan Buddhism, they say anger is that which we pick up when we feel weak because we think it's going to make us strong. You see the energy in it, which is strong. You see the brittleness of it, the tunnel vision of it, which is not so strong. You see, like, the nature of anger. That's mindfulness. And you see that it's constantly changing. This thing that has come up that we have thought of as solid, permanent, unyielding, when we really look within itself, it's moving, it's changing, it's in flux. Because everything is. So I've sometimes said to people, because there are some practices where you purposefully bring up an emotion so you can take a look at it. So I've said, okay, if you're going to look at anger, come back and tell me 3 things you found within the anger, and one of them can be change. You know, so it might be sadness, fear, change, whatever. Right? That's what mindfulness is. When we're not fighting, and we're also not lost in something, that's the platform for learning or insight on all kinds of different levels. And so there's a huge range of practices in mindfulness of the body, of feeling, in the sense of emotion, feeling tone, pleasantness, unpleasantness, neutrality, mindfulness of thoughts, mindfulness of everything. And they're all designed so that we can have that kind of clarity about change, about things having component parts. Seeing our experience more as it is, rather than as we imagine it's going to be in 15 years. Right? So that's that whole range of practices. There's another whole range of practices, another category, which are more like what I call the stretch. And that is having a kind of creative spirit, a sense of experimentation, so that you realize I usually look at things, I look at myself, I look at others from a particular angle. What's it like when I switch angles? What's it like when I give some airtime to something that may be true but is not that common in my experience? And so, beginning last night, I was talking about a gratitude practice as one example of a stretch, where researchers say one of the most powerful healing things any of us can do is keep a gratitude journal, right? So that was three things. Write down three things at the end of the day that you feel grateful for from the day. And as I said last night, I always say one of them can be that you're breathing. You know, it doesn't have to be something just magnificent. And as I always say, in truth, that doesn't come naturally to me. I'm much more likely to come to the end of the day and think about what I can complain about. That's my personal conditioning, it's my cultural conditioning. Who disappointed me? How did I disappoint myself? What went wrong? What about that airline? You know, what about that company? What about that? That's why this woman who worked in the call-in center, they talked about it, it's like amazing. You know, it's just the way I have been conditioned. That's where my attention would more naturally go. So for me to think about three things I'm grateful for from the day is a stretch. It's purposefully, intentionally moving my attention to something, some place it doesn't usually go, ordinarily, just through the force of habit. So that's the kind of example of the practice of loving kindness. It's not moving your attention from a true place to a phony place or a pretentious place. It's moving your attention from a true place to another true place that may not get much juice from us just through the force of habit. So, you know, as I started last night, if you're the kind of person who at the end of the day sort of evaluates yourself, almost as though to ask yourself, like, how did I do today? And if you're the kind of person who pretty well only remembers the things you did wrong and the mistakes you made and that really stupid thing you said at lunch at that meeting, let's just say, so much so that that list gets so intense and so consuming, it feels like it's your only reality. So the stretch isn't being phony, and it's not make-believe, and it's not like saying, I am a perfect person, and I had a perfect day. But it's allowing yourself to include that which you normally might exclude. The good within yourself. The good that you've seen. Wishing yourself well instead of chastising yourself or berating yourself. Remember meditation as a resiliency skill, the ability to begin again. I probably don't have to have you think of how rare it is to appreciate the opportunity to begin again and how common it is to spiral down because we have to, right? We got lost, we forgot. We struggled, we got distracted. It happens. What an amazing thing that we have the capacity to begin again. That may not be the particular angle with which we usually look. So it's a stretch. It's like an experiment. What's it like to wish myself well? What's it like to look at some of the people I usually look right through? People who play some kind of function in my life, checkout person in the supermarket, or you know, somebody who I don't feel close to, but is there. What's it like to look at them instead of through them? What's it like? You know, what's it like becomes the operative word in loving kindness practice. So we're going to explore that practice through the rest of today and tomorrow, and the nature of that way of paying attention and what that means in particularly adverse or difficult times. So as I said, when we do that practice in terms of method, rather than gathering our attention around the feeling of the breath, or in walking, the feeling of the body moving, we gather our attention around the silent repetition of certain phrases. And the first way we're going to do this practice is walking, which will get us up and out, which is good. In loving kindness practice, while walking, and again, if walking is difficult in any way, it doesn't have to be done walking, but it's some of the same principles, eyes open, some activity, some sense of being aware of others around you. We rest our attention on the silent repetition of certain phrases, and it's the same kind of light awareness that we cultivated before, because you want to be aware of everything around you. And we do loving kindness while walking. It's totally at a normal pace. You don't have to slow down unless, you know, there's a space constraint of some kind, or you really, really want to. But I do this practice all the time walking down the streets of New York. It's a great practice to bring into actual life situations. So there are, again, many ways of doing this. I'm going to suggest my favorite way, and we're going to have some time to do it, and then come back and begin to explore loving kindness as a sitting practice. So we choose certain phrases, and in walking, we have this light awareness, resting our attention on those phrases as we are walking or moving around. The phrases, both in sitting and in walking, are generally phrased as, may I be happy, may you be happy, something like that. And the spirit, the feeling tone of it is that of blessing. It's offering, it's gift giving. And remember, that comes from a sense of inner abundance. Sometimes people don't like that way of phrasing, like may I, may you. It sounds too much like pleading or begging. Here I always go back to my friend, my colleague, Sylvia Borstein, who said, she told me once, it's the hortatory subjunctive part of speech. It's like you hand someone a birthday card and you say, may you have a happy birthday. May you have a great new year. May I be happy. May you be happy. Like, it's got some verb to it. It's not really begging. And the way I like to do it in walking is basically in walking along, centering my attention on the phrases for myself. And walking, you know, because it's a somewhat complex activity, people may choose a couple of phrases. You can have more if you want, but usually it's something like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. So I walk along silently. This is also important, especially if you're in a city, silently repeating, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. And then if someone comes strongly into my consciousness, I hear a bird, I hear a dog, I see a person come by, or a car full of people go by, or I see a bug, or even somebody just pops into my head, somebody from home, I just quickly include them. Like I get a sense of them, and it's like, oh, be happy. And then I go back to the phrases for myself. So there's a baseline, which is the phrases for oneself, and then there's like the play. Because you never know. Maybe you hear a dog and you're afraid of dogs. It's a very interesting moment, like, oh, be happy. Whatever. And as I said, you know, it's really interesting. Like I do this all the time walking down the streets of New York, and it's like play. It's really having fun. Because the judgments will still be there, like, that's an awful shirt. Oh, be happy. You know? And you get to see what each feels like. And then just go back to the phrases for yourself. And there will be many times, no doubt, in which you need to let go and begin again. Because your mind will just go a million miles away. It's okay. That's how the practice is actually done. Okay, so we're going to take about 40 minutes, which will also give you time for a break.